Hello, and welcome to episode 208 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
We spend a lot of time talking about how to get kids off their phones. We limit screen time, block apps, and try to set better examples ourselves. But in all this talk, one voice is often missing: the kids. This week, we're taking a look at what happens when we actually ask children, something a story in The Atlantic did, what they want, and how their answers revealed not just a desire for less screen time, but for more connection, more independence, and more real-life experiences. Rick, I shared with you this story of The Atlantic, and we'll link to it for everyone else to see, but how surprised were you by what these kids actually said?
I'm not really surprised, but I was encouraged by it, put it that way.
Yeah.
And it's largely consistent with what I've been hearing from college students. So I've been pleased to hear that this goes all the way down. It also affirms something that I've been hearing in talking with teachers and school administrators who, when, for example, cell phone bans are applied, there's resistance, often more resistance from parents than from the kids. And then they end up hearing from the kids that, oh, these classes is so much easier now because they aren't on their cell phones all the time and they can focus better.
And just to be clear, the sort of surprising, at least to maybe both of us, a revelation in this Atlantic article was when kids were asked how to spend less time on their screens, they said what would get them off their screens was simply more free play time with friends, unstructured, in person, and without adult interference. And when they dig into this a little more, I think part of the appeal to being on phones for many young people is that that is a place, in many cases, and again, many parents have sort of these apps, I guess they are, that sort of sit on top of their phones that restrict maybe some sites they can go to, or even maybe monitor conversations if they choose to. Again, there's all sorts of settings one can set that up in ways that are more or less restrictive. But the biggest takeaway here is that kids find their digital life one of the few places where they're not have parents looking over their shoulder. And I think there are so many times with, you know, kids today, and more importantly, parents today, who just are really resistant in letting their kids be kids and letting their kids explore their communities, their cities, spend time with their friends without having to constantly check in, or without having to be, oh, it's not safe for you to walk four doors down to visit the neighbor because there could be a car that careens off the road and runs you over, and all these fears that parents have. So I guess it's an interesting way to think about it, because kids are well aware of these restrictions that parents seem to be more and more putting on their lives. And they say, well, one place I can connect with my friends without that pressure is online. And that's an interesting way to sort of reframe this. And it does, and I worry a little bit that this is sort of kids knowingly or not sort of taking away some of the responsibility they have in monitoring their own screen time. But maybe it is a reminder for parents to say, hey, if I want my kids to spend less time on these devices, I need to give them more things to do out in the real world. And that really is an important shift in how we look at this.
Yeah, and you said give them more things to do and give them more things to do, but more freedom.
Yes.
To do what they want to do and to do it with their friends in ways that aren't strictly supervised or highly organized. So what kids are saying basically is they want more freedom. They want more freedom especially in their social interactions. But because they aren't being given that opportunity face to face, they get the freedom for the social interaction on their phones.
Yes.
And so there is a second best means of getting what they want.
Because, I mean, kids today could be, and some are, right, of spending all that time just sitting in front of a television and sort of passively watching reruns or I mean, you can sit down and watch stuff all day long. And not that phones are sometimes like that, right? Phones are, I mean, video has exploded across all the apps. Look at TikTok. I mean, that's a great example, right? But there is more, when you talk about social media and its downsides, it can still be social, right? And there is that element to it. And I think that because kids, in many cases, are not choosing to just sit passively in front of a TV and just watch whatever's on, but they're going to try to interact with people who may be in their class, who may be friends around the corner, who may be acquaintances around the world, that it is seems to be, at times at least, sort of a way to make connections that they're otherwise unable to do.
It's no surprise that children are going to spend a lot of time on phones. You give them something that's highly entertaining.
Fine-tuned to their interests.
So it allows them to engage with the world, even though it's a virtual world, and engage with it in a lot of different ways and ways in which they get the control. Now, in ways they aren't controlling it as much, it gives them the perception of control because it's also designed to be highly addictive. And it's highly structured, but it's highly structured in a different way than having somebody telling them what they have to do. It's feeding them things according to certain algorithms. They don't feel or aren't really cognizant of the ways in which the structures are confining their choices.
But yes, but they are still making choices, right? I mean, that is part of it. I mean, that they, maybe it's illusionary in a way, but they still, in many cases, decide what button to click, when to go from one app to another. It does give kids at least the sense that they have some control over this digital journey they're on at that minute. And I think what this story tries to say is, we have just taken away so many choices kids seem to have in the non-digital world that going into, you know, spending 3 hours on your phone is as sort of like, I don't say it sounds crazy, but it's not crazy at all. Kids do that every day. Spending 3 hours on your phone to kids seems like, hey, I've just made so many choices about where I go and what I do. And you know, you click on a video about horses, you're going to get 22 more videos about horses. And you're like, well, it really knows I like horses. I mean, it kind of gives, like, there's sort of this feedback loop that sort of makes you feel like the choices you make are being listened to. And all that's fine. And it's all designed to make money and keep kids on apps. And that's both good and bad. But I think if the takeaway is that at least part of this is because we don't give kids enough time to make those choices, whatever they are in the real world, well, that hopefully is a wake-up call to parents.
It should be. Yeah, it should be, because these apps are designed to give children the illusion of autonomy, knowing that this is something that all children desire more of. They want the ability to make their own choices and to run their own lives. And childhood is a period of incrementally increasing autonomy. As you get older and show more responsibility, you get more and more control over your own life. Because children are seeking this, when you restrict their activities in one area, that is to, like, to say, go out unsupervised with other kids and to have autonomy in that respect, they're going to look for other ways. And what the digital devices do, unfortunately, is they're really clever at giving children this illusion of autonomy, so making it seem as if they get to make all kinds of choices about what they want. And yet it's designed to be highly addictive. It doesn't improve their ability to engage in the real world more fully. And for increased autonomy, like what we consider full autonomy when you become an adult, It's mainly about your power to understand the world and your power to do things in the world that really expand your choices. If you can do more and you're more aware of your options, you have much more autonomy because your range of choices in life are much, much greater. And so that's what we're trying to develop children into. And it said, when you supply them with these devices that give them these kind of artificial choices where they get to choose A versus B versus C, they get to click different things. But it keeps them limited to this virtual world that is highly artificial, highly constructed. They don't increase their power or their capacity for understanding. And so it's really bad. And in some respect, I think a lot of children are both aware of this, and yet in the moment, it seems like it's giving you more freedom, mm-hmm. right?
I'm curious if you think this is strange or not. It didn't at all feel strange when I was a kid, but for 2 years, our family lived in Rochester, Minnesota. And I know exactly how old I was because we lived there for when I was in sixth and seventh grade. So sixth grade, you're probably 11 and maybe sort of like 11 and 12, 11 and 13. Does that seem about right?
Yeah.
So those were the only 2 years we lived in Rochester. Now, I can't tell you how many times this happened, but it was more than a couple. And I just have, and I'll tell the story. And I think my assumption is that there aren't many 11 or 12 year olds who would do this today. But we lived in Rochester at the time was a city of about 60,000 people, not a big city. But for those who don't know, the absolute number one thing in Rochester, Minnesota is Mayo Clinic. And Mayo Clinic, even back in the 80s when I lived there, was this major medical center, had many different buildings, and these were all downtown, and it was a big deal then, and it's gotten to be an even bigger deal now. And I don't know why this was like something I did, and obviously I'm sure my parents had to know what I was doing, but we lived, kind of in a very middle-class, normal neighborhood in Rochester, and I was maybe 3 or 4 blocks away from a city bus stop. And there were a number of times I would walk those 3 or 4 blocks, get on the city bus, this is all by myself, well, and there were other people on the bus, but I was traveling by myself, and take the bus downtown, get off the bus downtown, and because Rochester, Minnesota is a cold climate, and they have all these clinic buildings scattered around maybe at the time an 8 or 10 block area in the center of the city, many of these buildings had what they called pedestrian subways, which were basically underground tunnels that would connect either the hotels to the clinic or clinic building to clinic building. And there was sort of this maze of underground tunnels in Rochester. And I thought these were fascinating. So I would get off the bus downtown. I would find my way down there and I would spend an hour or two walking around these tunnels. And I say tunnels. I mean, sometimes they were some of them, again, this is all in the early 80s, things could absolutely have changed, but some of them were very utilitarian. They were kind of had these tile walls, and there was nothing, you almost felt like you were in like a prison hallway at times. But then some of them had like shops, some of them had little restaurants, some of them, you kind of walked through and you were in almost like a hotel ballroom because that was some banquet space of a hotel. And I would just spend, it seemed to me like a couple of hours wandering around there. And I also knew, even as a kid, that occasionally famous people would go to the Mayo Clinic to get help. I'm like, oh my gosh, maybe I'll see like a sports or movie star. Guess what? I never did. But I just found this like to be a fun thing. And like, I'm sure the first few times I would get lost a little bit and then I'd kind of figure it out. And then after a couple of hours, I'd hop back on the city bus and ride it home. Now, you could argue that that's like a weird thing for someone who's 11 years old to want to do. But I have a feeling that if I was an 11-year-old today and wanted to do that, not many parents would think that's okay. So without you judging my interest in wandering around underground tunnels in the middle of Rochester, Minnesota, do you think this was like an okay decision my parents made to let me do that?
Yes. And also what I found most fascinating by that story is that occasionally you would get lost.
Yeah.
Then you'd find your way again.
Yeah. And I never once felt unsafe, right?
Right. I think the opportunity to get lost and then find one's way again.
Because, of course, I did not have a smartphone, by the way.
Right. I think it's a really valuable experience because what it does is it really enhances your sense of being able to navigate the world and navigate uncertain situations. Absolutely. I think your parents were wise in letting you do that. Whether it was intentional or not.
And do you think, am I right to say that that's probably not very likely to happen now? I mean, I don't know. I probably have enough self-awareness for what I'm sure other adults, whether they were employees or Mayo Clinic patients or whatever, would like see me wandering around. Of course, they had to. But like, I have no idea if they're like thinking, why is this 11-year-old walking around down here? I mean, this is probably in the summer months, I would imagine. But, or if they're like, oh, whatever, it's fine. But like today, I would wonder if somebody saw an 11-year-old walking around these corridors underneath city streets in a Midwest mid-sized city, people might be like alarmed possibly, or like I don't ever remember being approached like, are you okay? Are you lost? Are you looking for your parents? I don't think anybody even paid attention. I wonder if that may be different today.
Well, I think people would be paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah, today. People would be more concerned. What that also means is there would be more adults looking out for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's probably going to be safer today. And the internet is not a safe place. Like the vast majority of boys who have their own smartphones are accessing pornography. And
there was no pornography under the streets of Rochester, Minnesota, let me tell you.
Right. I mean, there was different places, right, that some kids would seek out and find, but it was relatively mild compared to what children are accessing. And so, like, our sense of what is risky for children doesn't have any connection with what's really going on in the world. And I think we have to be much more deliberate about this. So what is the kind of environment that's good for our children to be raised in? What do we want them to be exposed to? And I think children are saying, we want more freedom to navigate the real world and the real social world. And parents are saying, no, you're going to be safer on these digital devices. And it's just false.
I heard a podcast where some people were talking about this study in The Atlantic, and there was a woman on the show who I think is roughly my age, and she said sort of her first adventures out of the home, and I did not have the same experience, by the way, but she would say that her father would often hand her this is again 1970s, would hand her a $5 bill, say, here's $5, go down to the corner store, I need a pack of cigarettes. Now, there's a lot of reasons that would have happened today. The biggest one being 8-year-olds cannot and probably should not be able to buy cigarettes on their own. But I mean, this story is probably not uncommon for like the late 70s. And you contrast that to today, where the story in The Atlantic says that most 8 or 9-year-olds have never even walked down a grocery store aisle alone, and many times aren't even allowed to play in their front yards unsupervised. And it's funny in some ways because it is the people who are like roughly my age who, although I wasn't running to the corner store to buy my parents cigarettes, they didn't smoke, but like I was all the time riding my bike or walking to the corner store to buy a stick of gum or a pack of can or a box of candy. But today we just don't let our kids do any of those things. And people my age had that freedom in many cases. And we've in many cases raised children to not have those same freedoms that we enjoyed. And I just don't quite understand why that is, other than we just are bombarded with stories about these extremely real, but also extremely rare cases of like, well, there was one kid once who went to the store to buy a pack of gum and he was taken by a car and never seen again. And that's an awful, awful, awful story. But like, that's really rare. And I think that keeping kids from leaving the house and not giving them social interactions and not giving them physical activity in the long run is much more dangerous. And I'm just not sure how we got here, because parents who are so restrictive now were not nearly had those restrictive experiences when they were youngsters.
Well, it's one thing to see the studies, the statistics on safety relative to other times. And we know from the statistics that most places are much safer than people think they are and safer than they were in the past. The truth is, most people don't feel safer. And most people don't feel safer because they're not engaging in as much social interaction themselves, and they don't feel as much a part of their community. And so more and more we have people that are going, say, to grocery stores and mostly encountering strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more likely to perceive strangers as potential threats than people were in the past. And so these aren't just reflecting parents' attitudes towards their children and towards the threats to their children. They're also reflecting the ways in which the ways parents feel in society themselves. There's higher levels of social anxiety among young adults who are parents
mm-hmm.
than before. That gets communicated either consciously or subconsciously to the children.
And I, in preparing for today's show, read somewhere that a theory that what you said is true among some parents, but then other parents sort of feel peer pressure from parents like, well, because the parents across the street are sort of hyper careful and probably go too far and restrict their kids' activities. But like, I don't want to be seen as the parent who's so permissive. And then what if something not awful, but like not good happens to my kid when, you know, let's say I say, oh, you know, spend the day out riding your bike. And you get a call from somebody that your kid fell and broke his arm and had to go be rushed to the emergency room to get taken care of. I mean, that's not going to ruin that kid's life, but it's like not a good thing. And then you're thinking, well, now people are going to judge me as a parent because I was so lax in my parenting that I let my kid bike across town unsupervised and he hit a patch of sand and fell and happened to break his arm. And so people are going to think I'm a bad parent. I don't want people to think I'm a bad parent. So I'm just not going to allow those sort of things to happen. And I just wonder if that plays a role.
Yes, it could. And it's hard for me to tell in a way because I'm so far removed from parenting young children right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just remember, like as a young parent, I loved opportunities for taking our children out in different kinds of social settings where they had responsibility to interact with adults. Going to grocery stores and being responsible for finding some of the food that we were picking up and having to roam the grocery store and go find it and maybe ask for help, you know, in a certain aisle. Going to restaurants, we didn't eat out very much because we didn't have much money. My children loved to go to buffets, you know, where they would get to choose their own food and you go down and look at it. And there aren't as many buffets as there used to be. I did not like the food lots of times, but like it was good for the kids, I thought, to be able to go and do that, get their own drinks, choose their own food.
And if you did that 7 days a week, that's probably really unhealthy. But like if you do it once or twice a month, it's probably fine.
Yeah, yeah, it wasn't very often. But then also, like, the kind of social responsibility that it teaches, like, we'll do this, this is a real treat, but it's all dependent on you being well-behaved. It was great opportunities for giving them, like, when they were very young, slightly increased autonomy, but also teaching a kind of social responsibility that you only get through practice.
And I had really mixed feelings about this because it was a few months ago. And again, I don't have kids. I've never raised kids. And we're at like a nice-ish restaurant. It's not fancy, but it was nicer than many. And we sit down, have a nice dinner. And like, I don't know if it was when we sat down or shortly after we sat down, there's like a table of six people near us. And like half the table were like kids under five. And of course, my first reaction is, oh, this is going to be not great. And they're going to be loud or that one's going to, you know, start crying or throwing a fit or not liking their food or, you know, all this. And so I'm kind of bracing myself for that. And then 20 minutes into the meal, I caught myself realizing that I had forgotten they were over there. And was it because they were so well-behaved and proper that I hadn't noticed them? No. It was because every kid was on an iPad looking at something. They probably had headphones because they had, you know, the parents didn't want to bother the table like us next to them. But these kids are learning that when they're out in a social setting, that good behavior is important, and but the best way to stay occupied is just staring at a screen. And I mean, so I'm like, this is great because I thought this was going to be a problem. It's not a problem because they're very quiet and engaged in something else. But like from a larger societal standpoint, that's probably not good. And I would wonder that if maybe the parents sort of had that same sort of dichotomy that like, this is great because the kids are being quiet and we're in like a kind of nice restaurant. At the same time, they're not really learning anything. So it's like, how do you balance those needs is sort of a question, I suppose.
They're not really learning anything. And crucially, they're not learning anything about both self-regulation in settings where it's they're responsible for restraining themselves and their behavior. That's a really important skill to learn when you don't want to be disruptive to other people. So you can't act the same way that you do in your household. And then learning how to interact with strangers, how to order your own meal and how to do it politely and how to interact with others like the person at the table next to you. These are so important because what they do is when you learn those things, you enhance your power to engage with the rest of the world. So you're increasing your autonomy. Children want increased autonomy, but they don't necessarily want at each moment the process that it takes to learn that, right? And so, and this is one of the challenges of parenting, but they do want it. And so the problem with the electronic devices is they can become this parenting crutch, which allows your children, say, to be well-behaved, but not learn the crucial things that it takes to be really well-behaved as an older child, as say as a teen or as an adult. That's really unfortunate. And what we see is when I talk to college students, like the number one thing that they want is belonging. It comes up over and over. Here's the thing. You can't have belonging without knowing how to regulate your own behavior in social setting and how to build social connection. And that takes thousands and thousands of hours of practice to learn to do well.
One thing I wanted to touch on before we go, although that probably would have been a good place to end, but I do want to go one more place, is that this morning I received an email that was not especially well-targeted because it doesn't pertain to my life, but I clicked and opened it anyway because I thought it might be a good topic for this discussion, and I think it is. The headline was something about how parents can make their morning routine easier. And it goes through, and I think this was sort of one of those advertorial emails where it starts off by saying how important it is to wake up, and you and your children, much of this was framed around kids, how to wake up to, you know, sounds and music that get the day off on the right start. And so here's a device you can buy maybe from Amazon that'll, you know, start the day off with some affirming music. And then it takes you through how you can get things so the room lightens up in just the right way. And then it talks about, you know, breakfast and, you know, how mom and dad might want coffee brewed just a certain way. And here's a coffee maker that'll do just that. And here's how you can make a healthy breakfast in somewhat simple ways for your kids. And here's how you can make sure that they have a good backpack and all these like step-by-step processes, partially to sell merchandise, but also to like make the morning routine for parents and kids easier. This was like kind of a long email to get through. And then I thought to myself about my morning routine as a kid. And I'm not saying this to be critical about my childhood or my upbringing at all, but there was a time, especially I think maybe like starting in eighth grade after my parents got divorced and after we left Rochester, Minnesota, is that my morning routine, and I remember this very well, was to set my alarm myself, wake up. I would have, I think, a bowl of cereal most every morning. And we were really lucky that the middle school I attended for those couple of years was like two blocks away. So I would, you know, get up, put on a jacket or boots or whatever is appropriate, and walk to the middle school. Now, I don't want to give the impression that my mother was like not around for this. I'm sure she was, and she was probably awake. And I just don't have like a really good sense of what she was doing during that time. But like, it didn't really matter to me. I mean, I'm capable as like your eighth grade, you're what, 12, 13 years old, to set my alarm, get up, have a simple breakfast, put on appropriate outdoor wear, and walk two blocks to school. That seems like something any eighth grader should be able to do. And it seems like we have turned what should be, in many cases, a pretty simple process into a really long routine. And I just wonder if we have sort of overcomplicated our lives in some ways to like think, well, I'm sure my mother was happy I have set my alarm and got up at whatever time I needed to get up. I don't think for a minute she was thinking, well, his alarm clock has this harsh buzzing sound. What would be an affirming sound for him to wake up to start his day in the right way? I mean, she probably would never thought that. And I mean, she should have thought that. I mean, she was just happy that it was loud enough to wake me up. And I just wonder that we have made parenting seem like such a chore that we have to fine-tune every decision, that if my son somehow comes home with a D on his English test, that, well, maybe that's because the drapes don't open automatically and give him that natural light so to get his day started on the right foot. I just think we've sometimes overcomplicated things so much that parents feel like they have to micromanage every step of the day. And because of that, we just sort of make our children into a chore versus a developmental exercise. So that's my monologue. Which of that do you agree with?
Well, I agree with most of it. Because the best advice I ever received as a new parent was, I got a book from a friend by Bruno Bettelheim, who had been a
that sounds like a character on like a kid's TV show.
I know, it does. He was a student of Freud. He was a Holocaust survivor. He was a child psychologist and a very famous one. But he wrote a book called The Good Enough Parent. And I don't remember what the book said. I remember reading parts of it. I just remember the title was so reassuring that you don't have to be a perfect parent. In fact, it might be counterproductive to try to be a perfect parent. You just have to be good enough. And that is, you need to provide an environment that is safe and that has and provides a number of opportunities, but then allow freedom and room for the child to develop and allow lots of opportunity for them to develop responsibility, which is the environment that you were raised in, evidently.
Yeah, and I think it seemed normal to me.
Yeah. And I would say my experience was very much the same. I don't remember getting up in the morning and having very much interaction with parents at all.
And you see like these like TV shows or movies where like even on a school morning, like the family of four sitting around a table and mom's flipping pancakes and, you know, people are talking about their home. I mean, I guess that's sort of some idyllic thing, but I just can't imagine that goes on very often. And then parents are like, maybe I should be more like that mother on TV. And I don't.
Yeah. I mean, once I was in high school, there, my probably middle school too. Well, I had a brother who was 10 years younger, and there was a babysitter who came over. You know, so when I'm 12 years old, he's two, and a babysitter. Yeah. The babysitter wasn't there for me or my sister. We were 11 and 12. We were supposed to get ourselves ready for school. And if we didn't get out the door and didn't get to school in time, we were in trouble with the teacher or the principal.
Yeah.
And so that was on us. Because our parents just weren't around. That seemed perfectly normal. And I think it was largely a good thing. It teaches a kind of self-responsibility. Now, if we weren't handling that well, there would have been consequences. And you probably knew that as well.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I hear you have a question for me.
Lots of times in basic social interactions, you'll go into the workplace or you see somebody at the store and they'll say, "How are you doing?" And the typical response is something kind of noncommittal, like, "Yeah, fine," or something like that. I had a friend who, like years ago, or an acquaintance, it was a work acquaintance, who always had a super positive response, like, "I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic." And it was kind of annoying to me. And yet, over time, I thought, what he's doing is he's trying to be encouraging for other people, and he's creating a certain attitude. And I was thinking, should I do the same thing? Do I have a kind of responsibility to set a tone for people's day in how I respond to them? So I'm just wondering, like, do we have a responsibility to respond in a certain kind of way when people ask us these routine questions like, "How are you doing?"
How are you doing, Rick?
I'm doing great.
Okay. In this scenario, this is one of the rare times where we can learn a lot from politicians. And let me explain. I think you first have to determine whether this is just truly one of those, like you're passing in the hallway, "Hey, how are you, Rick? Good. How are you? Great." And you're just going to continue walking and there's not time or intention to have anything more than that. In that case, you know, I don't really care. I think it's sort of like filling space, like, "Hey, how are you? Great. Good. Good to see you." You know, whatever. And then that's just like a pleasantry. And I'm not sure I have a strong opinion about that. But if you're approaching someone where this may be anywhere from like a 2 to 12 minute discussion, and usually 2 or 3 or 4 minute discussions, and somebody asks, "Hey, how are you?" Here's why you should think like a politician. Especially when it comes to debate and other, annoying journalists like me ask politicians questions, skilled politicians will try to take that question and turn it into something they want to talk about. And I think that's exactly what we should do in these situations. If somebody asks you a boring question like, "Hey, Rick, how you doing today?" That is an opportunity for you to say, I'll pick on something here in Wisconsin today, and this could change by the time the show comes out, but you could say, "I am doing great because right now the Milwaukee Brewers are having a fantastic year, and I am just so excited that the Brewers have the best record in baseball and look like they could go on to win the World Series. I've been a Brewers fan all my life, and I've never been as optimistic about them as I am right now." That takes a kind of a boring, "How are you doing?" into like, "Hey, what are your thoughts about the Milwaukee Brewers right now?" Or if you want to talk about how, like, just over a year ago, for example, we, during a thunderstorm, had a big tree next to our home fall into our house and had a large branch puncture our roof. And you would say to me, "How are you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, it's been a busy day. Why is that?" "Well, I've spent all morning long dealing with roofing contractors to fix this hole," and just sort of take a minute to talk about that. So I think if that is a way to strike up a conversation, but you can take that as the most open-ended question in the world and be ready to talk about something you want to talk about.
Is that what you actually do?
I think I try to.
I think you do too.
Maybe does that make me sound self-centered or something? I don't know. But to me, it's like more interesting than, "Oh, you know, same old, you know, works fine. And then I'll go home." I mean, nobody wants to hear that. So like, find something interesting and talk about it.
So I love that response. And you're not trying to just express a mood,
yeah,
which I think most people are doing.
Yeah, I mean, and sure.
Of some sort.
Yeah.
You're trying to lead it into more conversation.
Yeah. And again, you have to make a quick snap judgment that, yes, you have time for this. And like, there are people who I would never have a conversation about the Milwaukee Brewers with because they probably barely know who the Milwaukee Brewers are. So you have to kind of know your audience, right? But I think there are times where that's like a perfectly good way to like start a quick discussion about something and kind of blow past the, "Oh, I'm fine. How are you? Oh, good. How's your wife? Great." You know, I mean, unless you have like, oh, she was, you know, run over by a truck last night. Well, that's really a bad thing. But like, usually it's like, she's fine. You know what I mean? Whatever. So I think directing that discussion makes for better discussions.
By the way, are the Brewers doing well right now?
Yes, I'm sure you know this.
No,
I don't know baseball.
I follow the Twins.
Well, I am
somewhat, and the Twins have been tanking recently.
So, okay.
So I've kind of quit following baseball altogether.
So we are recording this, full disclosure, on the morning of August 12th. So I can only speak to what's happening right now. But they have, like, they are like, by five or six games, have the best record above among every team in baseball. They have the best record at any point this deep into the season in the team history. They are playing in the smallest market in Major League Baseball in Milwaukee. And there are a couple of like mediumly well-known players, but it is apparently a very easy team to fall in love with. They have a manager who has captured the imagination of the city. And even though it is a relatively small market, Milwaukee continues to either sell out or come close to selling out most of their games in their stadium. I am like you. I'm a Minnesota Twins fan. I don't hate the Brewers. I think the Brewers are a great team. I think they're a great organization. They also have a very low payroll. So, yes, they are having an extraordinarily great season at this moment.
I'm glad I asked you how you were doing because I had no idea.
Well, and of course I made it up. I mean, I'm actually a Twins fan and things there are not going quite as brightly. But yeah.
So it's still like great that the Brewers with a really small payroll are beating the pants off the Dodgers. Who are like
And the Yankees and all these teams with hundreds of millions of dollars of payroll. And I don't know off the top of my head what the Brewers' payroll is, but it is a fraction of some of those bigger teams. And, you know, there's all sorts of people smarter than me who can come up with the reason why they're doing so well. But they are undeniably one of the big storylines so far in the season across the game.
Oh, that's good to know.
But see, and I'm surprised you didn't know that. But nonetheless, at least like that's a conversation, you know, that was a bit contrived with your question. But like gets to something that's like that you walk away learning something about. And, you know, you didn't learn anything especially interesting about me. I'm not really a Brewers fan, although I think it's great they're doing well. But like, I think that is so much. So I guess, again, just to kind of go back to your initial point, treat these as open-ended questions and talk about whatever you want to talk about. Because and we always joke about, you know, in debates where somebody will say, oh, tell me about your immigration plan there, Senator. And like, well, they'll talk about the greatness of America and how, well, again, didn't really answer the question, but they're talking about what they want to talk about. And I think we should talk about what we want to talk about.
Thanks, Scott.
Anything else you want to talk about?
No.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life Podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you do still care about what Rick is talking about, be sure to read his column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.